Thank you. It's needless to say that I consider it a genuine honor and privilege not only to be here with you, but to have the distinction of introducing this next speaker. I am Mac, as Walter told you, and I am an alcoholic and a member of AA. And through trying to follow this program to the best of my ability, and with the help of God, I have not had a drink of alcohol in any form, nor have I used a substitute, therefore, since November 18th of 46. This has been a wonderful experience for me, and I know I share the feelings of all of you when I express my happiness over this event, and we're just getting into this. I know that we have much to look forward to today and tomorrow. But you know, this next speaker, I had heard about him through the years, and I look forward with eagerness to meeting him, and I'm looking forward to hearing his message. It's interesting to learn that, first of all, I was amazed to see that he looked so young, having been in AA as long as he has. He'll soon be 25 years old in AA. You know, I learned that Dr. Bob Smith was his sponsor, one of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that Clarence was the first member in Cleveland, and he is responsible for starting the AA activity in that city. Of course, as most of you know, in the early days, this fellowship operated in the Oxford, what was called the Oxford Movement, and I believe that Cleveland was the first one to break away from the Oxford Movement and start the AA fellowship as such. Now, he is the third oldest in point of sobriety, I understand, and will be 25 years old in February. There's another thing that was I was interested in this morning. We walked up the walkway there and were discussing the connection between physical fitness and sobriety and in general happiness and well-being, as a matter of fact. And I said to Clarence that I believe there is a very close connection between the two. I think it's impossible to separate the physical side of life from the mental side, and to which he agreed. I find that he plays softball with two groups in St. Petersburg, Florida. He plays with one group in the early 20s, and has been for 3 years. And I believe he tells me that they haven't lost a game in the past 41 or two games. Then he's been playing with another softball team of older people for about 8 years. So you can be happy and physically fit too, as well as being sober under the direction of this fellowship. Now, I've consumed my time, and without saying anything further, other than I would like to say that Clarence worked with Larry Jewell, who came to Houston later, and I believe the first AA we had in Texas was in Houston, Texas. So this is a wonderful fellowship. We don't know where the influence of the example we set will extend itself. And each one of us at this retreat, we cannot possibly measure the good that will come from our association and from the inspiration which emanates from the speakers and from our presence. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Clarence from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Well, thank you very much. This is certainly a pleasure to be here. And I do, first of all, want to thank you all for inviting me. This is my second trip to Texas. I had the extreme pleasure of being invited to the Top of Texas Roundup a couple years ago, and I found that to be an experience which I shall never forget. And when I was asked to come down here, I just didn't even check my schedule. I said, yes, I'll be here. I certainly enjoyed the people in Texas and the wonderful hospitality and friendship that I received here. I shall never forget it. You know, I look over this crowd here this morning, and I watched all this bunch of rummies eating breakfast, and I thought, what a switch. Breakfast yet, and enjoying it. Some of them going out and getting second and thirds, I see. You know, you're a wonderful-looking bunch, and looking at a gang like this, it reminds me of a story. I'm not much for telling stories in Leeds, but when I see good-looking people around, why, this comes to my mind. I was reminded of a story about Jerry, the town drunk. This fella Jerry had been drunk for 30-some-odd years around town, and no one had ever seen him sober. And finally, one day, of course, Jerry, he was always dirty and unkempt and had a beard on him, and his bare feet were on the ground, and he had those patent leather shoes, you know, his feet patting the pavement and a little leather on the top, and he had holes in his britches, and he's dirty, and he stunk, you know, and 30 years, you can certainly collect something, see? And so no one had ever seen Jerry any other way. So one day, Jerry turned up his toes and died. So the problem came of burying him. So the community, the people in the community chipped in and got him a funeral. And they got an undertaker, and the undertaker got him a new suit and a necktie and a shirt, shaved him up, cleaned him up real good, and got him a nice casket and laid him out in his casket. And then the thing to do, the job, is to get a preacher to preach a funeral service. So they finally tapped the preacher for it, and he couldn't very well refuse, but he was quite bewildered. He just didn't know what to say about this Jerry. What in the world could anyone say about a fellow who's been drunk for 30-some years and no one ever saw anything different? So he tried, so he got up in front of all these people. He says, well, folks, he says, our friend Jerry is gone. I don't know what to say about him. He says, we all knew him for what he was. He says, I'd like you to do one thing. He says, I'd just like all of you folks to come up and take a look at Jerry and see how good he looks since he quit drinking. Well, I think this happens to all of us. We change. And I was thinking about this while this introduction was in process. And when I came to AA, I weighed 130 pounds. I was quite a mess. I'm nothing much to look at now, but there's more of me, at least. But I was sick, and this thing of physical health, it is important. I was interested in him talking about this baseball deal, and I get quite a kick out of this myself. I'm kind of a freak, you know, down there in St. Pete. They all know me on that street, on the street as Duke Snyder, you know. They take me after a fella in the, used to be the Brooklyn Dodgers, and so I get quite a kick out of this, and playing with these young fellas, it's quite a deal, and we won championship 3 years in a row, lost one game in 3 years. That's pretty tough playing, even if you're playing six-year-old crippled girls. But it's a lot of fun. And I am very thankful that the Lord has allowed me to live and be healthy, because I was as near a dead as you could get when I came to this fellowship. And this fellowship, people in this fellowship are all miracles. I think we're all miracles. If you don't think so, consider this for a minute. You know, for thousands of years, or as long as history has been recorded, we've heard about alcoholism and alcoholics. You read about it in ancient history. You read about it in the Bible. Even old Noah got stiff and nearly fell off the ark. You can remember that story. So if these things are recorded about drinking and the effects of it and things that were tried. And really nothing effective has ever devised or came along till just a few years ago when this fellowship of AA came into being. Now, over these thousands of years, there has been millions and millions of people who have crossed the face of this earth, and they have been alcoholics. They've lived as alcoholics and died as such. And with them, they have carried along a lot of other people down that path of disgrace and heartache and heartbreak. This has been going on a long, long time. And I often think about this, and I think we all should think about this. Out of all these millions of people, and there'll probably be millions more coming, why is it just you and I, a few thousand of us, have this opportunity? It's something to think about. It's certainly something to be very thankful for. And I think it rests a responsibility upon us. This thing of a miracle, I think of my own story of how I came to this fellowship. It can't be anything else. I was told that I should have about 40 minutes to talk today, but that'll just be my first 40 minutes. And if you will, I'll have to tell a few of these things, and if it takes another hour and a half, I can't help that. You can all go out and get lunch and come back. I'll still be here. When I came to this fellowship, I just want to relate this, to point out what I mean by a miracle and the impossible happening. This was many years ago. As you heard, I have been over 24 years sober, so this was way back. I wound up, I had my last chance at home, which was predicated upon the idea that I should go to work as an assistant truck driver for my dear brother-in-law, a mooch. And me, who have always been allergic to work, and I coming into AA has not changed that allergy. I've never found any treatment to take care of that either. I still am. At one time when I came to AA, I started out in sales work, and I wound up carrying sample cases and getting blisters on my hands and getting calluses on my feet and getting round-shouldered carrying these bloody things. And I eventually got rid of them, and I found myself eventually getting a job where all I carry around in my pocket is a pencil and a piece of paper. And that is about as heavy as I want to go. And when they tapped me to go out a job driving one of these big tractor trailer deals from New York to Cleveland, why, that was quite a concession on my part, which I had to make, or else I would have been out of the house for good. But this was my last chance, so I had to take it. But of course, when I got on this trip, I got drunk before I got to New York. And my dear brother-in-law, he did nothing but dump me out in New York City on the waterfront. And he wrote his sister, who was my wife at that time, and told her what he had done with his no-good so-and-so. So he left me there. I knew only one person in the city of New York. There's probably 7 or 8 million people around New York at that time. He had another sister out in Yonkers. And I thought, well, Virginia will take care of me and look after me. So I made my way out to Yonkers. And when I got out to Yonkers, I had been there once in my life, and I remember she lived way up on top of a hill. But I didn't get up on that hill. I went down the other way. And I got down in Dago Town down there and got into some Dago Red with some Italians. And I got drunk, of course. And by the time I got to Virginia's house, I was a sight to behold, I guess, and I can only remember vaguely rolling around on the floor with her two kids, and this didn't please her. So she put me in her car and took me back down to the waterfront and booted me out and left me there where her brother had left me before. So there I was in New York City. The winter was coming on. I had no clothes. I had no money. I knew no one there. I hadn't a friend in the world. And I had no place to go back to. So there was no reason for leaving because there was no place else to go. So I existed in New York City a long time. And I found out how to exist there without money. I find out that New York's a great place. You can live there forever. You can exist there forever without working. If anyone wants the secret of this for a price, I will give it to you after the meeting. But I tell you this story for a reason. Sometime later, I don't know how much later, because I know the calendar went completely around, because everything happens to me in blizzards. When it's cold weather, everything happens to me in miserable weather. And this trip to New York, it was just beginning to be miserable, and it got worse all winter long. And I went through a summer, and it was back into the blizzards again when I got out of there. So I know I went around the calendar. But Virginia, this gal in Yonkers, whom I had gone out to see, sometime after I had been there, she had her doctor over for one of the kids. And they got to talking about drinking. And she told this doctor about this drunken brother-in-law of hers, and what a nice guy he used to be, the favorite brother-in-law at one time, and what an awful drunken bum he had turned out to be, and told him about this experience that she had with me. He says, "You know, that's odd." He says, "I had a drunken brother-in-law like that one time, and he met some kind of a cult. And since he's met these people, he don't drink anymore, and he spends all his time running around fixing drunks." And he says, "Besides," he says, "this brother-in-law of mine knows some doctor in Akron, Ohio, who also belongs to this cult. And he spends all his time fooling around with drunks, putting them in the hospitals down there and cleaning them up and getting them on their feet." And this doctor told Virginia that if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, why, maybe they can send him down to see this doctor in Akron and maybe they can fix him. So this is all going on. I know nothing about it. Till eventually I got back to Cleveland. I tried to get back into the nest, and my wife met me at the door, and that's as far as I got. But she did tell me about this doctor in Akron, Ohio, and asked me if I'd like to get down and meet him. And what could I lose? Well, of course, I'd love to meet him, you know. So she bought me a one-way bus ticket to Akron, and she put me on it and sent me down there to see Dr. Bob. Now, that was my meeting with my sponsor. I'd like to say that I listened to him attentively and eat it all up when he told me, but I can't tell you that because he scared the life out of me. I ran out on him. He knew too much about me, and I beat it. But I couldn't forget him. I eventually went back to see him, and he put me in the hospital, and then from that time on, everything was all right. The reason I tell you this story, this doctor in New York was Dr. Robert Strong, who happened to be Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. Now, there was no AA then. Bill Wilson was a member of the Oxford Group in New York. Doc Smith was going to the Oxford Group in Akron and had been for a couple of years before he ever met Bill, and he got drunk every night until he met Bill and he got straightened around. Now, there was no AA. There was no book. There was no such fellowship as we have here, but there was a few rummies in the Oxford Group in New York, and there were a few rummies in the Oxford Group in Akron, Ohio, and here I am, a stranger among 8 million people in New York City, and through this sequence of events, I get my entrance to this fellowship. If that isn't a miracle, you tell me what is. I don't belong here. I have no business being here. The odds were millions and millions and millions to one against my ever being here. But here I am. Here we all are. I think we're all miracles. And every one of us comes here. I never get over the miracle of this fellowship. I look at people. They come in here. They come in here the first time you see a person. He's beat. He's whipped. He's scared. He's sick. He's dirty. He stinks. And what? You see him a week or two later, you don't know him. If you haven't seen him in the meantime, you don't recognize him. He looks so different. He's walking different. He's talking differently. He gets cleaned up. He gets shined up. As you watch this development, it's so fast. Sometimes I wonder if it isn't too fast sometimes. But it's a tremendous thing. It's a great inspiration. This is one of the things that keeps me going to meetings. It really is. I never get over the wonder of it. It never gets old. People ask me why I go to so many meetings. Do I have to? Am I afraid of getting drunk? Actually, I never had any problem about getting drunk when I was drinking or since then. And drinking never bothers me, and it never bothered me then, you know. But the idea of drinking is very remote in my scheme of things. And I can't say that I've ever had any urge to drink, because when I got through with drinking, I was through with it. I'd had it. And if I perhaps, I'm probably luckier than some of the people who are coming in the last few years, because some of the people come in the last few years hadn't lost everything and hadn't got to the place where they had to drink the stuff I was drinking. But I paid 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I bought it in a wallpaper store. And if you think that anybody has a yen to drink that stuff, try it sometime. So it's not, I have no, there's nothing there that is attractive to me. I love this life. I love the people here. And this means everything to me. This is a miracle. When I went down to see Doc, I want to tell you something about how I came to this fellowship. Doc put me in Akron City Hospital, and I was in there for, I think, a week. And I remember this, that I was so sick and so shot that I wasn't even eating at the end of this week. When I left, I hadn't even started to eat yet, so figure this one out. We knew nothing about vitamins in those days. But Doc had these men come in to see me. Every day, these fellows would come in that were in the Oxford group there, and they would talk to me, the rummies. There were 18 of them came to see me. I know that because they wrote their names on a sheet, and I still have that slip at home. It's one of my relics. And they told me the stories of their life and what had happened to them. They're all older men than I was, 10, 15, 20 years older than me, all of them were. And all of them had really been around and been through the ringer. They told me what had happened, and as far as their drinking was concerned, and they all told me they had the answer to my problem. But none of them would tell me what this answer was. The last day I was in this hospital, I can still remember. This is why I know I wasn't eating, because Paul Stanley, he's dead and gone now. Some of you folks probably knew Paul. He came in at breakfast time, and he stayed all day. He ate my breakfast for me. He ate my lunch for me. I did get the dessert. And at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Doc came in, Doc Smith, and he sat on the foot of my bed, a very unprofessional posture. But he did, and he sat there looking at me a couple of minutes. And he says, well, this young fella, he always had a name for everyone. My name to him was always young fella, because I was a young one then. I was only about 35 at the time I come in. And that was young in those days. Isn't now. There's a lot of people come in much younger. He says, young fella, he says, what do you think of all this by now? He says, well, I think this is wonderful, all these fellas coming in to see me. And they're telling me all of the stories of their lives and all this sort of thing, and I don't know them from a bale of hay. It's wonderful, I says, but I said, they all tell me one thing. They tell me that they have the answer to my problem, but none of them gives me the answer. What is it? What do I have to do? What's the gimmick? See, when I went into that hospital, I didn't know what was going to be. I didn't know what this treatment was going to be that I was supposed to get. This was a medical doctor, and I was expecting that some medical performance was going to come into being here, and I was going to be fixed. But no, I didn't have any medicine. They didn't give me anything. I just shook. I didn't even take the whiskey they offered me. So I shook this out. So he says, well, he says, we're not too sure about you. You're pretty young. And we haven't had any success with these young fellows. They're all screwballs, we've had these young ones. And we don't know for sure that you're ready yet. I says, what's to be ready? I weighed 130 pounds, as I told you before. I had no home, I had no job, I had no clothes, I had no dough, I had no nothing. I had been whipped. I'd been on the bum for a long time. What do you have to do to be ready? Gee, you know, I think we ought to use a little bit of that reverse English on some of these rummies today. But anyway, I had to convince him that I wanted this thing more than anything else. Finally, he must have been convinced, because he says, okay, he says, if you really want this, I'll tell you what the secret of this is. So then I lay back waiting for this big unfoldment here. So he points his big bony finger at me, and he had him, fingers about this long. He was a big, long, gangly fella. Any of you folks who ever had the privilege of meeting Doc know that. And he could look right through you, look holes through you. He says, young fella, he says, do you believe in God? I thought, holy smokes, I didn't expect anything like that. This is no medicine. And I'm afraid of anything like this because I have been in missions before and I had been mixed up with these screwballs. And I wanted no part of this. But here I am, I'm in this hospital a week and I'm under obligation to a bunch of religious nuts. This goes through my mind, I'm not saying this. And he's waiting for an answer. So he says, well, he says, do you or don't you? I says, well, I guess I do. He says, there's no guessing about it, you do or you don't. This is a soft approach to the spiritual foundation. I like this soft approach people are getting today. So I says, well, yes, I says, I asked him, I says, what does that have to do with it? He says, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Then he asked me this question about, and I had to answer him that I guessed I did. He says, no guessing about it? He says, okay. I says, I do. He says, okay. He says, now we can get someplace. So I thought, well, now we're going to get someplace. He says, now we'll pray. I said, who'll pray? He says, you'll pray. I said, I don't know anything about praying. Now this is real good, you know. This is giving a fellow, it's easing it into you. So he says, I don't suppose you do know anything about praying. He says, but all you'll have to do is repeat after me what I say, and that'll suffice for this time. So he uttered some prayer, and I followed it. I felt like a fool, but it didn't kill me. I survived it. I'm glad I did. And he shook hands with me after. He says, young fellow, you're going to be all right. So that evening he carried me off to a meeting, and that was my beginning in this fellowship. This was not known as AA at that time. This was in the Oxford group. The book had not been written. We did not have the 12-step program. We didn't have any of the wonderful advantages that we have today, but we had other advantages that you don't have today. We had lots of rummies, and there was no doubt about their qualifications. We just could fall all over them. Now you wonder sometimes what you're getting. But these boys all came very well recommended by their own choice, too. Well, I survived in Cleveland. And this bunch was in Akron. And our meetings were on Wednesday night. And I made those meetings, and I never missed but two meetings in 15 months while I went down there. And that was because I couldn't get through on account of the snow. I didn't have a car. I didn't have the transportation to get back and forth. I didn't have nothing. I didn't have a job when I started out. First job I ever got, I got the enormous sum of $20 a week. And that was a lot of money, and I was glad to get that. This is depression time. You know, I'm the one guy in the world, I have an awful resentment that I have kept for all these years against Roosevelt. Roosevelt would not let me on his WPA. I am the only guy that I know of who couldn't make WPA. All the jug buddies of mine were on that, and they were getting the... Did you two? They let you off? Brother, we'll join... We'll make up a club. I didn't know there was another one. But all these jug buddies of mine were drawing their $18 a week or whatever it was, and I was mooching from them. And they wouldn't let me hold a flag even. So I wasn't very employable. And in business and another in industry, of course, it was out of the question. They weren't hiring rummies in those days. So there were a lot of good guys walking around the street with good qualifications. And they weren't drunk. But eventually I got to work selling. I had to go into selling. I had to go into something where I didn't have to give references. And you can get some selling jobs. They don't care how many banks you've robbed or how many second-story jobs you've done. So long as you can sell, they'll take you. And it was a living, so I had to do this. So I sold, and I'm still selling because I found now I can find a lot of time for loafing. I do more loafing than selling now. I'm on a 40-hour month. These people talking about 40-hour week, and I hear this meanie screaming about a 35-hour week. I'm way ahead of that guy. I got a 40-hour month I work, actually, and I survive. I get along much better than I did before, even with all the obligations I've taken on since I quit drinking. But it's been wonderful. Now, he took me to this meeting, and this meeting was a wonderful fellowship. Most people there were not alcoholics. They were non-alcoholics. The alcoholics were way in the minority. But I wanted to be with those people all the time, and I spent all the time I could with them. And several of those men took a great interest in me. I'll never forget this one chap. He did more for me, I think, to change my life than any person. Old Bill Van Horn. I always like to tell this story about Bill. He's dead now, too. Bill had been in the group about a year when I came in. And Bill had been a World War I veteran, and he had a small pension, which he got the first of every month. And when he got that pension, he'd just like an Indian when he get drinking. And he never got over the idea that he couldn't lick the whole police force. He had a lot of knots on his head and stuff like this. And they used to really shillelagh this poor bird. But he'd always get in all kinds of trouble. And finally, his family just couldn't put up with it anymore. They had him probated and put in a nut house for life. They threw the key away on him. And he was in the Maslin State Hospital in Ohio. And that's where Doc found him. Doc Smith found him there and got him out. He wasn't any nuttier than the rest of us, only when he gets full of this booze. He was a big husky chap, rough and tough. And Doc got him into the hospital and into the group, and he never had a drink till he died many years later. He died sober. Never had a drink after that. Bill used to get me in a corner and talk to me. I don't know what attraction I had for him. He must have been one of these guys that like to pick up stray dogs and stuff, I guess. But he used to like to talk to me. I'll never forget the night he said to me, he says, "Clarence," he said, "I've got the answer to the whole thing for you, the answer to this whole problem." He says, "And I'm going to give you this." He says, "I want you to read this, what I'm giving you. I want you to remember it. I want you to memorize it. Don't ever forget it. Because here is the whole story in a nutshell." So Bill digs down in his pocket and takes out this old billfold of his and crammed full of a lot of papers and other junk. And he pulls out this little piece of paper, and I look at it, and there's a Bible verse written on it. And I look at that Bible verse, and I look at this big gorilla, and I think, well, maybe they let him out of this place too soon. A guy like this running around giving out Bible verses. But I did what Bill asked me to do, or told me to do. They didn't ask you. They told you in those days. They didn't ask you anything. Now they ask you. But then they told you. This is a suggested program now. Then they used to tell you, if you didn't like it, that is too bad. So it's a little changed over the years. But anyway, he told me about reading this, and I read it. And it was one of my favorite verses. It was 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, the 17th verse. And it reads, "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." Think about that, if that isn't our story. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Who can say that any one of you is not a new creature since you came to AA? Is any one of you the same as the day before you come in here? No, sir. A change happens to you immediately when you come here. You are touched with something, and you're never going to be the same. Some of you may be unfortunate and drink again, but you're never going to be the same. You're never going to forget this. There's going to be something happen here that's going to affect your life as long as you live. If nothing else, it's going to spoil your drinking for you. And it will. But I have never seen anything. I've known a lot of men and women, some women when I drank. I didn't know too many women when I drank, but I knew a lot of men. And those fellas, I've seen some of these fellas, how they've changed when they come into AA. I've seen some of those fellas that I drank with go on periodic sprees of sobriety. And it isn't like a sobering up process in AA. That it isn't the same kind. I've seen those fellas fighting this booze deal, and they stay sober. They're going to do it. They're going to fight this, and they're going to fight that, and they're determined that they're going to do it. But they have a different type of sobriety than you find here, a different spirit, a different look. This thing of this program of ours, this fellowship of ours, this spirit of this thing, we should never have a fight. This is a program not of determination. This is a program of resignation. We must resign ourselves to the fact that we are whipped and we need help, and of ourselves we are powerless. We must resign ourselves. Any guy that or gal that comes in here and is determined to beat this drinking business, he's beat to start with. He'll never win. He can't do it. He can't do it. You and I have had the best advice in the world. Everyone has told you, and they've told me. My friends told me, my bosses told me, my family told me, the police told me, ministers have told me, lots of people told me what was going to happen to me if I didn't quit drinking. And they were right. And they give me $1 million worth of advice, good advice. Never worked. Nothing worked till I hit this fellowship. And overnight, something happened to me. Every day something happens to me. I try to help this happen to me too. There's something we have to do for ourselves. We're given this chance. As Tommy always says, we're giving a free ride in here. When we come in here, we're given a free ride for a while. And I think it's important what we do with ourselves when we're on this free ride. I really do. But we're all given this chance. What we do with it, that's our choice. Believe me. Now, this program was developed to make it acceptable to people like you and I. When I came to this program, as I said, it was the Oxford Group. The Oxford Group was a group of people who were trying to live better lives. They called it life-changing. They tried to live according to the principles of the four absolutes: absolute honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. They had no steps like this. Eventually, these steps were evolved. Eventually, I could see at least that alcoholics had to break away from this group to give this fellowship a universality that it needed. Eventually, as you heard in the introduction here, Cleveland was the first group that started as strictly an Alcoholics Anonymous group. We divorced ourselves from the Oxford movement. The book had just come out. That book was written in the fall of 38. Cleveland started in the May of 39. We had the book. We had the 12 steps. We had a program. We had something to work with. And that's the way we started. I can't take the time to go into these steps like I'd like to do, but I would like to skip over them and give you some of my interpretation of what these steps mean as far as I am concerned. And I probably have a little different slant on these steps than some people do because I was in on the writing of them. So I know what they are meant to do and what the purpose of each one is. Because you hear a lot of people ask a lot of silly questions, and they're not silly to these people, but they really are when you get down to analyze them. They ask about what steps do they have to take and what don't they have to take and which one's first. Well, it says something in that fifth chapter that I think we could all do well to read over and over just before the steps are introduced. There's words that go to this effect. It says, if you want what we have, and if you're willing to go to any lengths to get it. Here is what we did. Then it goes into these steps. It suggests to me that these steps are written a certain way for certain reasons. The Oxford group, they called it life-changing. I think that we have the same problem here. We have to change our lives, and we certainly do. And I think the steps are broken down into four categories, four phases. I think that the phases of these steps are, first of all, these things have to be present if we're going to change our lives. There has to be an admission of a need. So our first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. So there's the admission that there is a need for a change. The second phase of this program to me is a phase of submission. There's admission, submission, where we submit our wills and our lives. We surrender. The second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We came to believe that. Doesn't say we believed it when we got here, but we came to believe it. I came to believe it because I wanted to. I met these other men, and their example inspired me. I wanted what they had. They had had this experience, and I wanted it. So I came to believe it because I wanted to. Our third step here is part of the submission. It says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. We made a decision. That's quite a deal to do. A rummy, that's beginning to separate the men from the boys. Unless we hurt real badly, we're not going to do that. No alcoholic is going to sober up on common sense, on logic, or anything else. An alcoholic is never going to change until he feels a certain way. You can give him all the common sense and logic in the world, and we all got it. But until we feel a certain way, we're not going to do one thing one way or the other. I often get up on these podiums, and they have this sign, Think, up here. I just turn it over. I just don't like to affront people in AA audiences with Think. Says, what in the world they got to think with? I found a sign going up to Camp Monroe last May, one of those big postcards that you find in some of the restaurants on the way up, and I was going through Georgia, and I found the ideal card. It had one of those big Think things on it. It had a line down through it. Underneath it said, Scheme. I took that up and I put that on the podium. That is apropos. This Think business is for the birds. So if we could think about this thing, we never would have gotten this mess, because we're not the most stupid people in the world, believe me. The alcoholic he has a lot of imagination, a lot of get up and go, and a lot of whiz to him. But thinking, don't hurt him by even bringing it up. But when we're making a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, that is a tough deal to do. Because here we're asked to turn our life and our will over to some nebulous character way out in the blue yonder here with whom we have very little acquaintanceship and probably mostly scared of and maybe just afraid to meet. And we're asked to turn our will and our life over to him. Boy, we got to hurt real bad or we're not going to do that. Believe me. So right then is where a lot of people are going to flunk out. This does separate the men from the boys. The next step is our step of taking an inventory. It says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Well, I don't think there's a rummy worthy of the name who can do that by himself. They talk a lot about honesty. I shudder every time I hear that word honesty in connection with AA. They talk about, do you have an honest desire for this and that? What does he know about honesty? I mean this. Don't talk to a new guy about being honest. When I was drinking, I'd steal a red hot stove. Anything. It's I'm telling you, the trinkets I used to bring home in my pockets at night. I would do this when I was still working and able to buy things. Anything I see laying around loose, I'd take. I might have a use for it later. But some of that doggone is bric-a-brac I used to bring home with me. Well, anyway, I'll never forget when I, this thing never leaves you, I guess. The first time I ever went to an Oxford group meeting, it was in the home of T. Henry Williams in Akron, and they had a beautiful home. He was not an alcoholic. He is an official in a big manufacturing plant there, and they have oodles of dough. And they had a home to suit their station in life, and they had the Oriental rugs, and in those days, Orientals were some pumpkins, I guess, and grand piano and oil paintings and all the other hoopla. And I remember all this bric-a-brac and silver things around, and I walked in that house that night. I made an appraisal of all these pieces, the smaller pieces. I really did. I can still remember that. I had my eye on a couple of these things. But I didn't take them, but that goes to show. Let's not stress this honesty too much till the guy gets to find out what it really is. Now, this taking a fearless and moral inventory of ourselves, searching and fearless, I think that you and I are too good at justifying ourselves to do that properly. I think we need someone at our elbow to help us. And I think the next step suggests that we have someone there, because it says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. So someone there was there helping us when we took this. I think that someone should help us through these steps. Now, when we get to admitting things, we're getting someplace, because an alcoholic never admits anything. But here we are. We're admitting already. We're making decisions, and we're admitting we're wrong. And that, and admitting that we had failings and things, that's something for us to do. Now then, our next step, it says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. We can't remove them. Remember, it says we were entirely ready to have Him do it. Remember that. We can't do it. If we had been able to, we'd have done it long ago. So we're entirely ready to have Him, and have Him, all of them, see? Then we said, we humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. We humbly asked Him. We didn't make any deal with Him, we just humbly asked Him. Then our next phase is a phase of restitution. Here's a phase that I think we need help, because I think that a lot of harm can come from people trying to make restitution with their heart and not having a head yet. And I think that some people who have finally found a head somewhere should help these people that don't have one yet. And this is where this help comes in. It says here we made a list of all persons we had harmed, and here's the important thing, and we became willing to make amends to them all. This attitude of willingness to make amends to all these people, that's what's important. Our attitudes in AA are so important. It's not just what we say, not just what we do. It's how we feel, what our attitude is, how we lean towards things, what's in here. Then it says here we made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would be harmful to them or other people. That's where we can get in trouble. In our enthusiasm to overcome and to make things right, an alcoholic doesn't want, he can't wait till tomorrow for something to happen. It has to have happened yesterday already. Our impatience is legion. The impatience of an alcoholic is legion. He has none. He don't know anything about patience. We have to cultivate that virtue. So right away, someone says he's going to have to go out and make restitution and apologies and this and that. Boy, he goes, see, and he says the wrong things at the right time, too. And I think he needs to, some of the things we've gotten into have to be handled a little bit more, with a little bit more diplomacy than what this fella has been accustomed to having. So I think that these restitution steps should be taken with the help of a sponsor. Now, our last phase is a phase of construction. We have admission, submission, restitution, and construction. These are four things that are necessary to establish a new life and keep it going. Our construction steps start with our tenth step, which is our daily check and our daily admittance of being wrong. We are checking ourselves every day on this step, this tenth step. And when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. When did this ever happen to an alcoholic? When did he promptly admit it? It's a wonderful tonic for us because an alcoholic never admit anything when he's wrong. He never could. You go down to court sometime. I know some of you have been down listening to court cases. It's interesting. It's your civic duty. You should do this once in a while to see what's going on with the rest of the world. And you'll see a drunk come up in front of the judge. You'll see a rummy come up there. And brother, he's been out. He took his car. He ran into a milk wagon. He tipped over a police cruiser. He went through a plate glass window, hit a fire plug, gets out and fights the police. And they take him down for the DWI and so forth, and a few more charges. So he gets up there in front of the bench, right? They read the charge, and the judge says, "You were drunk." "You? Me?" "Well, you were drinking." After a lot of this wheedling goes on, he'll finally break down and admit to having had a couple of beers. Never in my life have I heard of any alcoholic getting in trouble who really drank. It's only those guys that had a couple of beers. So if you ever drink, stay away from those couple of beers. They're murder. That's what happens. So you never admit anything. You don't admit it's raining outside. It might involve you in some deal. So don't admit it. But here we are, we're admitting it. Why do we promptly admit these things in step 10? It takes us off this defensive. We don't have to go out and defend ourselves or apologize for ourselves anymore. Let's cut that stuff out. An alcoholic who comes in here and accepts this program can walk with his head up. He can meet anyone. He can meet anyone. You know it yourself. You know, I'll bet you half of you folks that are sitting in this room were just like I was. When you came to this group, you couldn't sober get up and talk in front of two people. You couldn't open your mouth. You'd be scared to death. Any one of you can get up now and talk before your group like you've been doing it all your life, like you're talking to your own family. You can do it. Big difference, big change. But you don't have to apologize for yourself. You're different people. You're somebody. You're going somewhere. Let's not make any excuses for ourselves anymore. I'm proud to belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody can say anything they want about me for belonging to this. I can think of some of the things they used to say about me before I belonged to this. Believe me, I prefer this. And this has been the means of my anything that I might have in happiness and satisfaction and joy, I've gotten from this fellowship. I am privileged to belong to other organizations, other lodges and clubs and such things as that. As you heard, I am in athletics and things like that, and I couldn't do that stuff before. All these things have been because of AA. These are just some of the benefits. Just a few. There's so many more. So let's not apologize for ourselves to anyone. The 11th step is the second one in our construction. This is our step that teaches us how to pray. And what to pray for. Most of us have gotten so far away from a prayer life, we have to have a beginning. Read this step very carefully. Think about it. Go home and read it over and think about it. Read it tonight before you go to bed. Get the import of it and what it means. And this gets us started into a prayer life, and it won't offend anyone. It can't. It says here, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. That's what we're seeking. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Now, what are we praying for? Praying for only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Is there anything complicated about that? We want to get acquainted with this God who we've turned things over to and turned our life over to. We want to know how to communicate with Him. We want to know how to talk to Him. We want to know how to listen to Him. This step tells us. We sought through prayer and meditation to establish this contact, this conscious contact with God. And we're only seeking for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. Do you think if we earnestly consider that 11th step, we'll ever be directed to get into the things that cause us to drink? Not by a jugful. It's impossible. Can't do it. If we are trying to find out what he wants us to do, if we're trying to find out how to communicate with him, we're not thinking about these other things that have caused all this misery in our life. After we learn how and we get into a prayer life, there are other things we can pray for. We grow in these things. This is the beginning. This is only the beginning. From this point on, other things happen. I've seen some remarkable things happen through prayer. I've seen the results of it in people coming to AA. I've seen things happen to people in AA. I saw a remarkable experience. I was in on this experience just 2 weeks ago, demonstrating the power of prayer in a healing in AA. I think we're all healings. I think we are. But I saw one of the most dramatic demonstrations of the power of prayer about 2 weeks ago that I've seen in many a long day in AA in Tampa, of a girl there. And she was fearfully ill. And overnight, like that, this thing, everything cleared up. And doctors said it couldn't happen, but it did. Don't ever sell this idea short. Every one of us here is here because of someone's prayers, I believe. Whether some of us want to admit it or not, it's probably true. But we are given a chance here to learn how to do this and how to live this way. Now, this 11th step is a powerful step. We should all give an awful lot of consideration to it. The 12th step is probably the most maligned one of the whole bunch. You hear all kinds of talk about 12-stepping this and 12-step that. What does the 12th step say? The 12th step says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, it infers that we have gone through these steps. We've gone through this program and something has happened. What's happened? We've had a spiritual experience. Well, what's that? What's a spiritual experience? A lot of people get scared when they hear that. It's very simple. It's something that you and I all have had. We have it when we come here. Some people have dramatic experiences. Some people don't realize they're having it. Most people in AA, they all change. Every person changes. And some of them change very quickly. We all develop. We all grow. This thing of change, spiritual experience to me is a change of heart, a change of feeling, a change of attitude, a change of being, a change of soul. It's a change in here. It's not a change here, it's here. That's what this experience is. When you believe what this program says and you accept what this says, something will come over you. If you don't give it lip service, if you really believe it, you'll feel something within yourself. And I know that a good many of you have experienced this. This is a program, we always hear this, let go and let God. And that's what we need. When we let go, something happens to us. That experience comes to us. So it says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps have taught us to accept something. They've taught us to submit ourselves. We have admitted something, we've submitted, we've made our restitution, and we're constructing a life. This 11th step is terrific. The 12th step, let me say, it says this, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. Tried to carry this message. We didn't carry the alcoholic. We tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. That means all of our affairs. You know, once you come into this fellowship, as bad as con men as most of us are, I'm a salesman and I have dealt with salesmen, a good many of them over these years, and I've had charge of some of them at various times, and I've hired them and fired them and looked for them and lost them and what have you, and run the gamut with them. And I know what attitudes fella has to have to be successful in selling. And I know what methods that a lot of people use in selling. But I have found out, to my satisfaction, that a person can sell much better the AA way than he could the con way. I found out it pays. I found out this in working in a line of business which is full of con men. I sold education for about 7 or 8 years, correspondence courses. And have you ever found a bigger bunch of con men and burglars in any line outside of books and automobile salesmen? I don't know where they are. But these fellas, I'd meet them and they had these encyclopedia men, all these guys. They all have a certain way they pitch this deal. And some of them think you have to be a con man or a crook to do it, and you can't convince them otherwise. And I tried my best to convince a lot of these guys this stuff can be sold straight. And I sold it straight. I got a great satisfaction out of it because no one could ever tell me, you told me this, that, and the other thing, because I'm sure I didn't. I told everybody the same thing. And I told them the truth. I set some records with this concern that I worked for so many years. I only tell you this not that I'm bragging about it, because I'm only telling you because I want to emphasize I did it the AA way. I did it straight. And it works. It works well. If I had made a failure of it, I would mention it. But it was a success. I worked for a concern that had over 300 salesmen. And all the 7.5 years I was with them, I was never under number 10. I never crooked the deal. Quite proud of that. But you try to tell some of these guys that. But you can tell a rummy that if he wants to recover. And he better believe it. He better believe it. Because it says something about practicing these principles in all of our affairs, not just when we come to an AA meeting. But all of our affairs mean something else. It means our daily work, our contact with everyone. Well, I've run over my time, but not too much. I'm surprised at myself. I can go on, but I'm not. I have enjoyed being here with you. And it's been a blessing to me, and I hope it shall be to you, and I know it shall. I think these retreats are wonderful. I go to the one in North Carolina, which we held twice a year. And you know, we were talking about it last night. Someone said this. They have a lot of things in AA for new people, but they don't have anything much for the old people. And I'm an old people in AA, and I think these retreats are for me. Because I tell you one thing it does for me, and I think if it does for me, it should for everyone. I sure get my batteries recharged when I come here. I sure do. Because I'm here with people who are seeking something, people who really want something out of AA, and are looking for it and are getting it. And I talk to people and I see the inspiration. I get a lot of inspiration from people here at these retreats. I try to make all of them that I can. And to me, I think they're going to be the salvation of our fellowship. Because this thing, I can look back over the years. I've had almost 25 years in AA, sober, and worked. I've always worked in it. I've always been active. I've never been inactive in AA. And I've seen a lot of changes in it. Bound to be changes over the years. And a lot of the things are for the better, and a lot of them are not. But these retreats, I think, are going to be the means of balancing off the things that are not for the good of AA, believe me. And I wish you the best of everything, and God bless you all.